Welcome to Radio Gorgeous. Radio Gorgeous, we'll never let you down.
Rosie Rankin-G, welcome to Radio Gorgeous.
Thank you very much for having me.
You are a Paris-based author.
Indeed.
Yes, you can say that.
Yes.
And your book has just come out today, The Last Kings of Sark, which, of course, is because Sark was feudal until recently.
Well, to a certain extent, yes. I mean, the first time I went to Guernsey to do a reading of the book, I had a few people who had come to the event because they did think it would, well, they hoped it might be a history book. I'm afraid it's not a history book. The Last Kings, it's very much a kind of modern, looser iteration of kings. They aren't really kings. It's more the kind of, I don't know, the bravado of youth that makes mm-hmm. them kings, probably.
Yeah, I mean, it's a coming-of-age story.
Very much so.
Sort of set mostly in a mostly idyllic summer on Sark.
Yes.
Where it seems like the light kind of suspends them and is a character itself. Could you tell us more about Jude, Pip, and Sophie?
Okay, so, first of all, I'm really glad you mentioned the light, because that is, it's very much, the opening of the book is incredibly bright and sun-infused. It's almost kind of sun-bleached to a certain extent, which is why the second half of the book throws that slightly into perspective. So Jude, Pip, and Sophie, those are our three main characters. Jude is the narrator, she's 21. She has come over to Sark to be a tutor for 16-year-old Pip. The problem is, Pip's father, the family expected that Jude would be a boy, so that's a little bit of a curveball early on in the book. Jude is, she's quite self-conscious, she's not very free with herself or her body, but that's something that kind of changes slightly over the summer. Pip, again, he's very awkward. He's not used to spending time with characters of, well, with, not characters, with humans his own age. And those two characters, their insecurities and their strangeness is really changed and shaken up by the presence of the third party, and that's Sophie. And she is the Polish-British chef for the summer. She's a 19-year-old girl. A lot of the light in the book really does emanate from her, because she is this kind of magnetic character who really kind of loves the world and the people in it. So it's really about their triangular relationship.
And how it culminates almost in the final evening on Sark, which also then reverberates around
exactly
their early adult lives.
Precisely, precisely.
Very much, yeah. This book in its novella form won you the inaugural Paris Literary Prize.
Yay!
Yes, which is put on by the very famous Shakespeare and Company bookstore in Paris. And it was their first biannual offering of this prize.
It was truly an amazing experience. I was moving to Paris to write a novella, and I knew I wanted to write a novella, despite the fact that, you know, they were not, you know, very, it's not a very popular form, particularly within the publishing industry.
Because a novella is defined by being between 20 and 30,000.
Between 20 and, I mean, the definition does vary. Between 20 and 40 or 50, even up to 50 can be considered a novella. But, you know, there are various reasons why novellas don't get published, you know, unless it's already a very famous. It's not, you don't really launch a career in any way with a novella. Well, you could, but it might be a very bad idea. I mean, who knows? But
we'll see.
No, this is you know,
proper
this is
novel.
Very much a proper novel now. But so I knew I wanted to move to Paris and write this novella. And the day I was leaving, my dad found a little advert in the TLS advertising the Paris Literary Prize, and he's like, "Rosa, this is for, you can move into Paris. This is for a novella. This is kind of perfect, right?" And I mean, the reason why it was perfect was that it set me. I had various goals because of the prize. I was like, write my first 3,000 words, make them good, you know, for this November deadline, and then write the second half. And then, you know, so it really, I mean, that to me was all I really wanted from the prize. It kept me writing it. And I really had I didn't even cross my mind that I might win. And I remember sending the organizers a message saying, this was a week after we were supposed to find out. And I said, like, I know you've told everyone. I am actually in Paris, so I would love to be able to come to the event because I was shortlisted. I would love to be able to hear the readings. And I got a message on my terrible, terrible phone at the time, which said, "Well, Rosa, you will come to the event because congratulations." And then I couldn't load the rest of the message, so I didn't know if it was congratulations, you're a runner-up, or congratations, you know, the shortlist will, you know, get a token of. I didn't know what it was,
and
so
you'll be given a single red rose.
I spent 20 minutes trying to refresh this email, and finally I did, and it took a long time. I just burst into tears. It was glorious. It was really glorious.
It seems sort of, I mean, you didn't have the expectation, but it seems semi-fated. You know, your mother is Maggie G, who's a novelist and recently brought out a memoir, an autobiography. Your father's a journalist and published author. I mean, have you always wanted to write? Did you always know that you were going to write?
Well, just one thing I want to say about the Paris Literary Prize is, the reason why it did make me cry, and the reason why it was so absolutely wonderful is that it was judged totally anonymously. And actually, I spoke to a couple of the judges afterwards, and they had thought I was a boy the whole way through.
And
that really did mean a lot to me because, of course, I mean, the way the world works, people... Yes, of course, I mean... It shouldn't work like this, but occasionally connections do help, and people, you know, they've heard of a name before, those type of things. And I am so hugely, entirely, and forever grateful that that was not the case with the Paris Literary Prize. So that's one thing. In terms of parents being a writer, me trying to be a writer too, I've said this before, but I do think that children quite frequently just see the jobs that their parents do as the jobs that adults do. So it's not
it was in your purview. I mean that's what you saw.
I mean I thought about lots of other things. I wanted to be an archaeologist all through my childhood. I wanted to be a songwriter. No one's ever really liked my songs. There are various things. I think it's very easy to retrospectively analyze things and decide that they were fate or meant to be, but normally you just go through life and do lots of different things, and then some people tell you you're good at certain things, you put more effort into that, and then it kind of hopefully continues. So it's not really that I was not a 7-year-old who thought, I wrote terrible stories at the time, but I was not a 7-year-old who thought, you know, I only want to be a writer and that's all I want to do. It was something that I just came from practice and real enjoyment and luck.
And why did you want to move to Paris? I mean, who wouldn't, but...
Well, I've lived in Paris on my year abroad. I studied French and Spanish at university. So I spent 6 months in Paris on my year abroad. I worked at the International Herald Tribune and then at a kind of burger restaurant bar thing as a waitress. But I love Paris, and it felt very natural to me. It just looked the way I wanted a city to look, and it was the right size. I think size is such an important thing for me because I grew up in London and...
It's massive and sprawling.
It's huge. I mean, you travel... Two friends live on other sides of London. They travel for an hour each to meet, you know, at a pub, and you pretty much have to leave straight away because you've got to get home before the last train, whereas Paris is infinitely cyclable, walkable.
It's much more compact.
Yeah, and I think as a young person who doesn't drive, who really... likes feeling independent, it at least gave me even if it was false, a sense of independence quite and self-sufficiency quite quickly.
Okay, and in Paris, you've got a number of other pursuits. Talk to me about A Tale of Three Cities.
A Tale of Three Cities, I founded with Alex Tiegi Walker, who we had a magazines together at university as well, called The Fun and Beautiful Journal, and that was really fun. So along with another friend, we all kind of separately, well, I moved to Paris, Alex stayed in London, and Ralph moved to Berlin, and we thought that that very much reflected the movements of young creative people at the time, and so we made a magazine around that, and we've done two issues. I think the truth is that our other freelance demands have kind of pulled us away from that, so I don't think that that's necessarily continuing, but it was a really wonderful thing to do. Met lots of writers, lots of interesting people, and we also, in order to fund the magazine, set up the book club, which is a really, really fun evening, and we've done them in London, Paris, and Berlin, The one in Paris is in the home of Georges Bizet, the writer of Le Carmen, and the bar we do it in is called, fittingly, Le Carmen, and it's all gold gilt and high ceilings and really wonderful. And the premise is very simple. You turn up with a book, and if you don't have a book, no matter who you are and how much you beg, you will not be allowed in by the bouncer. And once you're inside, you swap with someone else in the room. So it really gives you license to talk to... It's not... We don't have... I mean, authors come, but they're not there to necessarily read.
And not everyone has read the same book.
That, no,
it's
not
like
not
a
at
book
all.
Discussion
you
group.
Bring
it's
a book,
a
that,
book
the,
club. A
you
book
bring
sharing
a
club.
A book that you love, and you swap it for a book that someone else has loved.
Wow.
So you get lots of great conversations. Some people turn up and, you know, they've bought a random book and they're not too interested, but some people get into real debates. They, you know... We've had couples, lots of couples have formed from the book club, lots of friendships.
Really?
So one of our favourite anecdotes is a very good looking couple. The good looking thing is not really necessary to mention, but it does set the tone a little bit.
Makes it more glamorous.
So this dazzlingly good looking couple met on the second book club, and by the third they had matching tattoos. So.
No way.
I don't know if they were literary, but
they say Le Carmen.
Product placement, yeah, they got free drinks for them.
Caipirinhas all around. Fantastic.
Follow us on Twitter, radio_gorgeous. Lots of love, darlings. Mwah.
What was the path for The Last Kings of Sark from novella to novel?
So I had an agent. I contacted an agent and showed her, Caroline Sutton, showed her the... It was a very skeletal version of The Last Kings of Sark that won the prize because I had to cut it down so much. But I showed her that. And this was while it was shortlisted. And we met for lunch, and she said, I actually knew, I found out the day before that I'd won the prize, but I couldn't tell anyone. And I wanted to have lunch with her and see whether she wanted to represent me, regardless of whether I won or not. Mm-hmm. And she did, which was good. So when I won the prize, I had an agent. The truth is, I thought things would be very... instant and quick, but the publishing world isn't like that. You know, I thought, you know, should I do revision this week and then we can send it out straight away? And it's like, no, we've got time. I mean, there are other things happening in the world, don't you worry. So it did take time, and I spent that summer following, really making the novella fuller and more fleshed out, and the characters, allowing them to speak more and have more space. And then I met with Virago. I came in and saw Lenny and Victoria, and they really, really liked the book, but again, voiced the concerns of publishing a novella, and so gave me really like free rein like, to do something else with it afterwards, or to do short stories that were related, or to do what I did end up doing, which is taking the characters and really following them post-novella, because quite frequently you finish a book and you do want to know what happens to the characters, and it was really wonderful to be able to do that, to have
to
a look into their lives.
Yeah, as a reader of The Last Kings of Sark, I would have felt, if it just ended sort of on Sark, it would have been a little unsatisfying in that way.
I hope that it is satisfying to a certain extent, but it's very... But it is limited. As I said before, it's almost some bleach. You know, it's innocent. Mm-hmm. And that is the point, because that innocence can never really last. I mean, they don't go on to become murderers or drug addicts or anything like that. It's a lot more rooted in, you know, kind of a prosaic reality of one's 20s. But yeah, I was very glad to... I think there is a strong... pulsing sense of nostalgia that is through the first half of the book and also onwards. Mm. But I really think that nostalgia is only earned by the time you get to the end, because you realize why, you know, rather than...
Well, and everyone does have those, I hope. Most people do experience those unspoiled summers or whatever time, whether it was in university of, you know, being with in intense friendship relationships, in intense experiences, but that are also untroubled by past, present, you know, past or future or you know, any other major...
Oh, entirely. And I think it's particularly heightened by the fact that they are or maybe not all of them, but I think they are all at a kind of a turning point, junction in their life, an end of childhood, a beginning of adulthood. So that sense of innocence and separation from the adult world is really heightened by the fact that that cannot last.
Mm-hmm. Yes, yeah, it's an artificial. Precisely. It's an artificial, yeah. Case. Which is also, tell me about the setting on Sark.
The setting on Sark. Why Sark? Why Sark? Well, I was invited out to Sark by a good friend at university. She asked if I wanted to come be a private chef with her. And she said, would you like to come to Sark? And I said, where is it? What is it? It's an island. And I was like, we're off to the Maldives. Going to be brilliant. We were not off to the Maldives. We were off to the Channel Islands. But that was totally fine because Sark is really wonderful. It's just strange. It's got this kind of... People say that islands are microcosms. And, well, they're definitely, mm-hmm. They're intense and they're condensed. And there's a kind of a wonderful English, but not really English, eccentricity, thank you very much, which is, very much, magnified there. It's 3 miles long. There's no cars. If you have to get anywhere around the island, you have to go by tractor or by your own feet or by bikes.
There's no lights. It's one of the few places that's habited that they've actually managed to have, sort of no light pollution.
Oh, no light pollution. I mean, there are lights inside houses, but there's no
street lights.
I mean, it's like going back in time, as mm-hmm. people say, but it really is. And I think in considering what my preoccupations were before I set out to write the book, which was, as I've said, this kind of this end of youth and end of innocence and all of those things, to me that did seem like a ready-made setting for that, because mm-hmm. implicitly it is, struggling against time and struggling against a sense of future or even, current day reality. So I liked that tension, and I just liked the place. I thought it was wonderful. Mm.
Having not been there myself, I felt like you could get a really good sense of Sark and that insular quality.
Mm.
Well, I mean, it was until recently a feudal.
Until 2008, it was the last place in Europe to abolish feudalism. I mean, it's not that on a kind of a day-to-day sense you really notice that, but it's a true quirk. I do talk a bit about class, and there are definitely there are different levels of
stuff. Yes,
there are power dynamics. Both Jude and Sophie are employed by the family, but they have very different roles and sense of status in the household according to what their mm-hmm. tasks are. Yes. So there is stuff about class as well,
which I felt was
important to do. And like.
And also almost in feudal, like the governess and, being of the same class but
exactly.
needing a gig. And, whereas below stairs, the cook
exactly.
Is
probably from another country or at mm-hmm. least, a different vocal range and
yes.
all of that.
Yeah.
So that's yeah. definitely there.
Yeah. Yeah. Wonderful. It is a very beautiful book. So what are you going to be working on next?
Yeah. Well, currently I also do... I have to feed myself.
Mm-hmm.
No, I do advertising work as well, copywriting, sloganeering. I find it very fun. So I'm currently working on a few briefs for that. But at the same time, I'm working on novel 2, which I've kind of been... It's been tormenting me. I've been tormenting it. It's been quite hard to wrestle down, I think. I mean, as everyone knows, first novels often... they are very autobiographical and based on experiences, and you've been kind of growing and nurturing and marinating these characters inside of you for years and years and years, and they seem whole already at the point of writing. And I think a second novel can feel, to the writer at least, and in the early stages, a little more contrived. But I don't want it to be contrived, of course.
Yeah, because the thing you've been doing since the first novel is working on
first novel.
That's been
and
the
I'm
experience.
Not going to fall into that trap of having a narrator who is a writer who can't write their second novel, even though that does seem quite natural to me right now. But yeah, so So we'll see. I'm not giving away any hints now. I mean, the body is growing.
How exciting, though.
Yeah.
Really exciting. So tell me about, which I think I approve of, solidism.
Solidism. Solidism it was our manifesto for A Tale of Three Cities, and it was really, it had kind of two prongs to it. One was the idea of an enjoyment of a solid form, so the printed word, books, and a kind of, you know, a suspicion of digital things like Kindles, because you couldn't really see, you know. There is something so wonderful about reading a book, loving it, and being able to see that you've made it thicker, you know, that you have contributed to its shape, even in terms of, you know, your mind, but also literally the book. So solidism in terms of that, the printed word. And so the magazines we printed were only printed, and we had none of our content online. And secondly, it was kind of about writing style as well. Solidism in terms of things being rooted in the tangible and the specific, and a kind of eschewing of cliches and generalisms.
Mm-hmm.
That's me remembering it like 3 years after we wrote it initially. But I think I still...
Very passionate.
I still stand by it. Yeah. I still stand by it.
Well, as I was saying earlier, I'm not allowed to have a Kindle.
You
husband.
Banned yourself or your husband?
Oh, no, my husband's banned because he works in book production, so he makes the books.
So it's either the Kindle or the husband. I'll go with the husband. It's kind of warmer. Better to share a bed with.
A lot heavier, though, just like the books. I bought a copy of Hilary Mantel's Bring Up the Bodies.
It's a big book.
It's a big book. And when you're falling asleep and it falls on your head, it's really quite painful.
Yeah.
So it's quite solid.
Yeah, I mean, there must be devices for that. Surely there are. Maybe like a kind of face mask with two poles that would erect this book in front of me. Oh, it's true. I do it. I mean, I do it with my mobile phone all the time. It just constantly, it's semi-breaking my nose.
Well, thank you so much, Rosa.
Thank you very, very much for having me.
Absolutely lovely. And good luck.
Thank you.
And congratulations.
Thank you.
And take over Paris when you get back.
Try.
RadioGorgeous.com.
Always when we fight, try to make you love till everything's forgotten. I know you hate that. Always when we fight, I kiss you once or twice, and everything's forgotten. Not yet begun, and everything is quiet, and it's all.